Your lines are now live.
Hello. Welcome to our press teleconference. My name is Tom Pelton, and I am Director of Communications for the Environmental Integrity Project. We're a 17-year-old, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to enforcing environmental laws and strengthening public policy to protect public health and the environment. Today, we're having a press conference to release our new report, The Thin Green Line, Cuts to State Environmental Agencies Threaten Public Health. It is available on our website, www.environmentalintegrity.org. We're going to have five speakers and then take questions from reporters. Before we get started with our conclusions of our report, I'm going to walk you through a little bit of what we did in our research. In our investigation, we looked at the state records of the lower 48 U.S. states, at the pollution control programs run by their state environmental agencies. So we did not look at state parks programs or hunting and fishing programs, just pollution control programs run by state agencies, like the EPA runs at the federal level. And we also looked at the operating spending of these state environmental agencies, not capital projects like water treatment plants, which are often big one-time expenditures, and they go up and down dramatically from year to year, just the operating expenditures of state environmental agencies across the U.S. And we studied the state budget documents themselves to get the data in our report. And then about 2 months ago, we emailed all of our data to the individual states to verify it and ask for feedback from all of the states. We got feedback written from 16 states, and we incorporated that in the end of our report. But we told all the states what our conclusions were about 2 months ago. Okay, that was the process. Now we're going to describe what we found in our examination of state environmental agencies across the U.S. Our first speaker is going to be Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project and former Director of Civil Enforcement at EPA. Just to let you know, next, after that, we're going to have Luke Metzger from Environment Texas. We'll have Ann Rolfes from the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. We'll have Drew Ball from Environment North Carolina, and we'll have Dr. Indra Frank, the Environmental Health and Water Policy Director at the Hoosier Environmental Council. First, we start with Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project. His name is spelled S-C-H-A-E-F-F-E-R. Go ahead, Eric.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks to everyone for joining us. So over the last decade, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has lost at least 16% of its budget and staff. So today its workforce is smaller than it's been since way back in the Reagan administration in the 1980s, although EPA's job has gotten bigger since the 1980s. Now, the federal EPA's budget gets attacked every year by people who don't want the agency to have the resources it needs to enforce environmental laws that protect public health. Those attacks are sometimes sugarcoated by the argument that much of what EPA does can just be handed off to states. But the data we released today shows that most state environmental agencies shrank between 2008 and 2018. In many cases, their spending and staffing declined even faster than EPA's. And that matters because states do have a critical role to play in protecting the environment and our public health from dangerous pollution. Our federal laws allow states to take on the primary responsibility for some of the most important requirements of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and other statutes. Those requirements include permitting, conducting inspections, monitoring air and water quality. And states pick up those tasks, after they've been approved to do so by EPA, and EPA has continued oversight to see whether or not they're getting the job done. Our report suggests, however, that too many of the states that have accepted those big responsibilities just don't have the resources, the money, or the expert staff to get the job done. For example, 40 states cut their workforce at the environmental agencies between 2008 and 2018, at a time when we kept hearing that they were taking on more of EPA's responsibilities. some of those cuts to staff were extreme. 38% in Illinois, 35% in North Carolina, 32% in Arizona, 30% in Louisiana. And when we talk about these cuts in workforce, we're talking about losing the engineers, the scientists, the lawyers, and their support staff who review and approve environmental permits, monitor air and water quality, inspect plants to make sure they're complying, manage the cleanup of contaminated sites. So we're losing people who had the expertise to carry out those responsibilities year after year. At the same time, about 30 states cut their total spending over the same decade from 2008 to 2018, and 16 of those cut their agency environmental budgets more than 20%. The deepest cuts were made in Wisconsin, Texas, North Carolina, and Delaware. Now, you might hear from some that budget cuts and staff reductions won't hurt because bureaucracies are streamlined and can do more with much less. Here are some reasons to be skeptical about those arguments. First, state spending increased substantially in many states. Texas, North Carolina, Indiana, and Pennsylvania are some examples where, at the same time, environmental agency budgets saw sharp declines. In those cases, shrinking environmental programs while state spending expands more than 40% in the case of Texas, that's more about politics than about streamlining. That's making a conscious decision to cut resources for environmental protection while the rest of the agency, the rest of the state budget continues to grow. Also, these environmental agency cuts are happening in states where business is booming and where the petrochemical industry in particular, refineries, chemical plants, gas processors, fertilizer manufacturers, liquefied natural gas terminals, those sectors are growing by leaps and bounds. So the state workload is increasing. Permit applications for a lot of those new projects, which involve boilers, furnaces, flares, tank farms that sprawl across 100 acres or more, can exceed 1,000 pages. Someone needs to read those applications and make sure the permits require the right pollution controls and are written to prevent industrial accidents. If we lose that capacity, when we lose that capacity, one of two things happens. Either the permits get rubber stamped, which we suspect is the case, or the backlog of permit applications piles up because the staff who are trying to do the right thing and actually read those applications just can't get through them. There aren't enough hours in the day. So nobody wins in a situation like that. The regulated industries have to wait a long time for their permits, or the permits get rushed through and leave the communities next to these plants exposed to some pretty dangerous risks. So last but not least, thousands of serious violations of environmental laws just keep piling up year after year without any enforcement response. EPA's database shows there are more than 2,000 sewage plants, factories, and industrial sites across the U.S. that are currently in serious violation of environmental laws, and that many of those have failed to comply for years. And that doesn't count the even larger number of violations that never get found because neither EPA or states have the resources to get out and find them. To understand what that means to real people, you can just look to the explosion at the TPC chemical plant in Port Neches, Texas last week, and other accidents that are piling up in the ship channel, and I expect Luke will talk about that some, but without the inspectors to get out and make sure these plants stay in compliance, we risk having more of these industrial accidents, more evacuations, more workers injured, more neighbors exposed to really harmful pollution in the years to come. So the bottom line is it's past time to give both the U.S. EPA and state agencies the resources they need to enforce our environmental laws and make them work to protect public health. And with that, Luke, I think you're going to give us the...
Yeah, thanks very much, Eric. That was Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project, The name is spelled S-C-H-A-E-F-F-E-R. Next, we'll have Luke Metzger, Executive Director of Environment Texas. His name is spelled M-E-T-Z-G-E-R. Luke Metzger. Go ahead, Luke.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Eric. Eric, I'm glad you brought up the Port Neches disaster. Just yesterday, there was a shelter-in-place issued for the community as elevated levels and unsafe levels of cancer-causing butadiene were detected in the air. People are ordered to, you know, seal their windows, turn off their air conditioning, and stay in place lest they be exposed to potential carcinogens. They closed school, canceled school for the next few days, which prompted the superintendent of the school district to say that this is getting ridiculous. And I think he's absolutely right. And unfortunately, these are not rare instances. We've had at least five headline-grabbing disasters and explosions this year in Texas, due to, we think, preventable mistakes that are happening at some of these facilities. The Houston Chronicle has previously reported that on average, there's a major chemical accident in the Houston area about once every 6 weeks. And so that's just to provide some of the backdrop for why I think this report is so important. I've been working on environmental issues in Texas for almost 20 years, and I knew there had been some cuts, but I was even alarmed to see from the report just how great the cuts we've seen here in Texas, 35%, second worst in the state, or in the country, excuse me. And, that comes as, we're seeing an uptick in these, illegal emissions events and fires and explosions that are, in worst cases, costing people their lives, in other cases, causing property damage or, threatening public health, with unsafe pollution. And that's just one category. And if you look at our water quality, one third of our rivers and streams are still unsafe for swimming or fishing. Two thirds of Texans live in areas where on certain days of the year it's not safe to breathe. And we're also just seeing a huge uptick in new polluting industries, including the petrochemical boom, going from the Permian Basin of West Texas, to the refineries and chemical plants along the Gulf Coast. Since 2009, carbon dioxide emissions are up 20%. To me that, at the time of increasing industry, increasing pollution in some cases, that we're cutting, environmental regulators, we need to be adding to them. And just one example, if you look at enforcement, Environment Texas and Environmental Integrity Project have, in previous reports, documented that, when companies violate their clean air permits via unauthorized emissions events, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality only issues fines at about 3% of the cases. And staffing levels and funding is a major part of that. Most of the time, the staffers don't have the ability to go out and inspect a facility on site and do a real follow-up and a thorough follow-up visit. They're just doing a desk review of documents, and so they don't have the ability to hold some of these polluters accountable. And then many of them don't have the engineering and public health backgrounds necessary to evaluate often highly technical documents. And so it just demonstrates that TCEQ needs more people on the beat, more people with technical expertise, and they need to be putting more money into things like air monitoring. There's only two air monitors in the area around the TPC plant. In the first few days, in some of those, one of those at least is 5 miles away from the facility. In the first few days after the explosion, TCEQ reported, told people that. But I think with more monitors out there, we might have learned more information sooner. And then finally, I'd say one of the examples the report points out is that pollution prevention programs have been especially hard hit in Texas. I think cut by more than 70%. I, in 2005, served on a pollution prevention advisory committee for TCEQ, which, helped guide and advise TCEQ staff on programs to prevent pollution. For example, we worked on trying to reduce the impacts of mercury switches in automobiles. But thanks to these cuts, that program doesn't exist anymore. So we don't have some of the expertise available to help push for pollution prevention. So I think in conclusion, I think we've got major environmental problems here in Texas, as elsewhere in the country, and this is not a time to be cutting funding. We need more regulators on the beat. Thank you.
Thanks. That was Luke Metzger, Executive Director of Environment Texas. Next, we're going to have Ann Rolfus, Director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Her name is spelled A-N-N-E-R-O-L-F-E-S. Ann Rolfus. Go ahead, Ann.
Thanks a lot, Tom, and thanks to everybody who's joined the call. It's interesting for me to listen to my colleague in Texas talk about what's happening there, because I would say, we've got a very similar situation here in Louisiana, where on the one hand, we have what are extremely alarming cuts in our capacity. Just to cite the report, we have a 35% decrease in our operating budget. And regarding the staffing, we have 296 positions lost. That's a 30% drop in the 10-year period examined. And so you might logically think that, well, if you have a decreased capacity for oversight and for protection, then you would then at least reach some sort of static level with your construction and expansion. But in the same period, the state of Louisiana has permitted 42, huge facilities, has 11 more on deck, and then we know, dozens more after that. So we have this onslaught at the very moment when we have a crippled capacity to protect our health and safety, and that is an alarm. That's a 10-alarm fire for sure. And, in Louisiana, we see very much what Luke has said. We see after these significant industrial accidents, we repeatedly see them come out and say, oh, we didn't find anything. But if you're not monitoring the air, you're not going to find anything. And we repeatedly hear from our state how everything's fine, our air quality is better. They're removing our state from these dangerous classifications. And yet, the reason that is happening is because we don't have enough people on the lookout. And that's an alarming situation. And I think, specifically here in Louisiana, we talk about, needing more money. We also talk about needing the will to actually enforce the law. We know that agency capture of our system has long been a concern. And I think it's really on evidence today. The head of our Department of Environmental Quality is a retiree of Exxon. He worked at Exxon for 20 years. So we need the will as well as the additional resources. I'm speaking from a Louisiana point of view, but I do want to emphasize that everyone in the country is affected by what's happening or what's not happening here, and thus should be alarmed. As an example, there is a huge facility, Formosa Plastics, being constructed or proposed to be constructed here in a parish called St. James. It would be the largest new source of greenhouse gases in the country. I think the implications for the entire nation and the world really are obvious. In a moment in time where you have some really serious work to try to reduce carbon emissions, here we have in Louisiana not only a plan to build a new carbon bomb in regard to this Formosa facility, but with very little oversight, as this report shows. The good news here on the ground is that we at least have some sense of the damage. So, for example, for the Formosa Corollary, another plastics plant that's already built in Baton Rouge, has been in violation of the Clean Air Act every quarter since 2009, and in violation of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act every quarter since 2004. And I think that's a very good example of where a reduced capacity is having an impact here. That Formosa Plastics plant in Baton Rouge is only 5 miles away from the Department of Environmental Quality. So, it's it's something that where there should be oversight, where they should be able to get there pretty easily and to take care of the violations that are very clearly happening. You know, we have a lot of examples in Louisiana of how people are impacted by this, right? In St. James Parish, you know, people go outside. Sharon Levine, who is the head of a local group called Rise St. James, talks about going out, you know, to her land to try to, you know, play with her grandchildren, and they have to go inside because the air quality is so poor. You know, we have repeated violators like the Formosa Plastics in Baton Rouge. You know, a couple of years ago, we had a 12,000-gallon oil spill in the pipeline right next to a neighborhood, and nobody was informed. You know, we have too many examples like that. We need more people on the job, bigger budgets, and the will to enforce the law. Thanks everybody very much for your time.
All right. Thanks very much, Ann. That was Ann Rolfus, director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Next, we have Drew Ball, director of Environment North Carolina. His name is spelled Drewball, Drew Ball of Environment North Carolina. Go ahead, Drew.
Thank you so much. We here at Environment North Carolina, we want to thank the Environmental Integrity Project for this important report, which shows a lot of what we've been seeing on the ground, and that's a 34% cut to our Department of Environmental Quality since 2008. And that's at a time when state spending has grown by 8%. The department has lost 35% of their positions. That's 376 staff. And this is a serious problem. The Department of Environmental Quality is the department with the statutory authority to protect the health of our environment and ultimately the health of our families. In a state like North Carolina, where we're seeing serious impacts from climate change, we are a state that has massive hog operations. We are a state with significant poultry production. We have seen emerging contaminants threaten our waterways. Those contaminants like Gen X and other PFAS chemicals. And in a state where we have numerous dangerous coal ash ponds across our state, and it's a sad reminder that here in North Carolina in 2014, we saw the Dan River coal ash spill, which dumped significant amounts of toxins into the Dan River, impacting our constituents up and down in that part of the state. So what does this mean? It means that here in North Carolina, we're seeing less testing, less water quality testing, less air monitoring across the state. We're relying more heavily on the EPA for our testing, which is slowing the process. And we have a backlog of permitting here in the state. There are too few people working to get those permits reviewed and out the door. In many cases, it's slowed, and in many cases, we're seeing rubber stamping because some of these permits are up against statutory shot clocks of time frames through which they have to get that done. So, you know, here in North Carolina, we're seeing these threats across the state, and without a robust Department of Environmental Quality, we're going to continue to face these challenges, and the skeleton staff that they've had to work with is incredibly problematic. And we thank the Environmental Integrity Project for this report and applaud them for all that they're doing.
Thanks so much. That was Drew Ball, Director of Environment North Carolina. Our final speaker is Dr. Indra Frank, the Environmental Health and Water Policy Director at the Hoosier Environmental Council. Her name is spelled I-N-D-R-A, Indra Frank, F-R-A-N-K. Go ahead, Dr. Frank.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you this afternoon. In Indiana, our environmental agency is called the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, so I'll refer to it by its abbreviation, IDEM. The repeated cuts to IDEM are hurting Indiana's environment, as in the cases of my colleagues on the phone. IDEM works to prevent pollution of Indiana's air, soil, and water, and is in charge of cleaning up sites that do get polluted. Over the last decade, IDEM's budget has been cut 20% when adjusted for inflation, even though that was a period of growth in overall state spending. And that's worth repeating. Indiana's environmental agency was cut 20% even while state spending was growing. The budget cuts have reduced items staffed by 20% since 2008. That means fewer inspectors, permit writers, scientists, and environmental engineers doing the work of preventing pollution or getting polluted sites cleaned up. Indiana has many environmental problems that are exacerbated by the budget cuts and short staff, and I'd like to give a couple of specific examples. For the first example, IDEM oversees drinking water safety at more than 4,000 public drinking water systems. That includes the small systems like campgrounds and rural schools, but also our small towns, and then large drinking water systems in our cities. Oversight of drinking water has gotten more challenging over the last 10 years as the science on drinking water safety advances. Despite the work getting more challenging, though, the budget cuts have meant that IDEM's drinking water staff has dropped from 62 in 2005 to only 48 staff in 2019. As a result, there was a 43% drop in IDEM's technical assistance visits for drinking water systems. This particularly hurts the small towns and rural systems in Indiana that can't afford their own technical staff. Another example is IDEM's state cleanup program, which oversees cleanup of sites that are polluted with hazardous substances. Because of the resource constraints at the agency, there haven't been enough staff to keep up with the caseload. In recent years, they've taken in more cleanup sites than they complete, so their backlog is growing. With the staff struggling to keep up, the agency has compensated by starting to assign its low and medium priority polluted sites to a, quote, independent cleanup process, which means a process that has no direct agency oversight. The organization I'm with, the Hoosier Environmental Council, is a not-for-profit that has worked on Indiana's environmental problems since 1983. We have a long history of being a strong advocate for IDEM's budget at the Indiana State House. This year, the Indiana General Assembly began to deal with the agency's long-term financial sustainability. They passed an important law, HEA 1278. This new law allows IDEM to update the permit fees that it charges. Most of those fees here in Indiana have been the same since 1994, so this was a welcome change from our legislature. I bring this up because some here in Indiana might reference this law as solving the problem of cuts to IDEM's budget. However, the law has so many constraints that even with full enactment, IDEM's funding will only hold steady at 2018 levels, and those levels are 20% below what they were a decade ago. So their budget will remain inadequate to deal with ongoing public health risks in Indiana, such as the abundance of lead drinking water pipes, millions of tons of untreated factory farm waste, millions of tons of coal ash in or near our floodplains, and hundreds of contaminated sites that need cleanup. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much. That was Dr. Indra Frank, Environmental Health and Water Policy Director at the Hoosier Environmental Council. We're going to go to questions and answers now. Real quick, I want to also recognize Jack Darren from the Illinois Sierra Club has joined us. And thanks very much, Jack. Really appreciate that. If there are questions about Illinois, I know that Jack has studied the Illinois EPA's budget over the last decade, and we can also set you up with interviews with Jack Darren in Illinois because he really knows that subject very well. So, Don, why don't you tell the reporters what to do to get in line to ask a question?
All right. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your keypads. Again, that is star, then the number one on your keypads. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. We will hold for a moment for the Q&A roster. All right. So our first question comes from the line of Darna Noor. Your line is live.
Hi. Thank you so much, y'all. Thanks for holding this. My question is for Anne. I just wanted to ask a little bit more about the projects that are in the pipeline in Louisiana, no pun intended, I guess. You mentioned that 32 new facilities were permitted during that time and that there's 11 more on deck. Could you talk a little bit more about what those are?
Go ahead, Anne. Anne Rolfus, Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so it's 42 is the actual number. And it's all manner of things, there's a number of liquefied natural gas terminals, along the Gulf Coast.
And I think that the area that I referenced, St. James Parish, is a good kind of microcosm of some of the projects that are coming, that they want to have come online, which of course we're fighting tooth and nail. But one is a big plastics plant that I referenced, Formosa Plastics. It would be one of the largest facilities of its kind in the world. The community did recently stop another smaller plastics plant called Wanhua, W-A-N-H-U-A, which was a $1.5 billion project. There are a number of methane facilities proposed for St. James, and a number of pipelines planned throughout the state, some of which would connect with the liquefied natural gas terminals. I know, too, that EIP has a pretty good knowledge of some of the facilities, you know, what we refer to as the petrochemical onslaught, right? That because of this cheap fracked gas, and these visions to export, gas and oil outside of the U.S. and outside of North America. That's one of the reasons for what we call this onslaught. So it's proposed for here in Louisiana, but also in Texas. And I think that EIP has a pretty good sense of the bigger onslaught nationally.
And this is Eric, and we can share that list if anybody wants to follow up with Tom of the very biggest project. And I also know you understand this better than anyone because you deal with it every day. That's a list of the very largest petrochemical projects. It doesn't include the hundreds of permit modifications that get processed by the state agency every year, and sometimes in a single month, where the plant is asking for permission to release just a little more pollution. And, you know, those changes add up over time, and they need to be reviewed also. So we're talking about 42 very, very big petrochemical projects, and there are hundreds of smaller ones as well.
I mean, we have a good list that we can provide any reporters that are interested. Thanks very much. That was Eric Schaefer. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of John Hurdle. Your line is live.
Hi. Thanks for holding the call. I just want to be clear on how these budget cuts have been selected. And so you're saying that they only apply to the pollution control programs of these agencies, correct?
Eric Schaefer of the Environmental Integrity Project, why don't you talk about what we looked at?
Sure. We were excluding programs that you typically find at the Natural Resources Department within a state that manage parks, that manage fisheries and wildlife, recreational areas. Those are more equivalent to the Park Service and Department of Interior programs you see at the federal level. And we were focused on pollution control and cleanup. Sometimes that's all done by a single environmental agency. Sometimes it's housed inside a public health agency or a natural resources department, and you just have to pull out the program data to get the spending levels.
So, but how easy was it to isolate these the pollution control programs within each agency's budget? I mean, do they have discrete line items that allowed you to make that calculation?
Yeah, most of them do. Keen, do you want to add it? We have Keen on the line who spent a lot of time.
Data analyst Keen Kelderman led the analysis of the budgets. Go ahead, Keen. Were you able to separate out pollution control programs?
It just depended on the state. Some states it was very easy. They put each individual line item in their budgets. Other states, all we could really get was the total. It really just depended on the state.
And, you know, just to be clear, pollution control, we're including permitting, inspections, enforcement, of course, but also the air and water quality monitoring, the science that goes into those programs, technical assistance to the regulated industry. So, you know, anything related to, the control or cleanup of pollution.
And we often found that the bulk of an environmental agency's budget was basically pollution control. For example, we look at the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. When we just look at the pollution control aspects of that, that was about 99% of the TCEQ budget that we analyzed. So a lot of environmental agencies that don't look at, that don't control parks or hunting or fishing, and those state environmental agencies, we're looking at the kind of the bulk of their budget, which was pollution control.
And just one quick thing to follow up, since I cover New Jersey and Delaware, were you able to break out these pollution control functions within those two states, those departments specifically?
Keene Kelderman, do you know anything about New Jersey and Delaware's budgets?
Looking at Delaware right now, it does look like we split them out, and we also split them out for New Jersey as well. One thing.
But is there any chance?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so one thing is that on the press release for our on our website, there's a link to an online map. If you click on a particular state on the online map, it'll take you to the raw data that we use to analyze.
So, okay. And if you want to send me an email to tpelton@environmentalintegrity.org, I can send you a link to this data map that'll give you detailed data for your New Jersey, Delaware states. You can look at it yourself.
Well, I think I've already found that, actually.
Okay, great.
Anyway, thanks very much.
All right, next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Tim Shelley. Your line is live.
Hi, thanks for holding this call. My question is for Jack Darin. So we know that the staffing cuts at the Illinois EPA have been pretty well documented over the last 10 to 15 years. My question would be, Governor Pritzker, when he was elected, he came in and said that he wanted to take several actions to promote green energy, to improve environmental regulation. Have you seen any indication from him or his administration that he's seeking to reverse this decline in staffing and budget for the IEPA?
Jack Darin, if you can press *1, if you're on the line, press *1, and then our operator, Don, if you can let Jack Darin talk. We might have lost Jack. You know what we're going to do? We're going to set up a phone interview between you and Jack after this call. What is your name once again? It's
Tim Shelley.
Which publication are you with?
WCBU.
WCBU. Okay. And what's your phone number, Tim?
309-438-4520.
4520. Okay, we're going to set that up, interview with him this afternoon. Sorry about the inconvenience there. All right, next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Eric Berman. Your line is live.
Hi, thanks for doing this. Question for Dr. Frank and then also a question for Eric Schaefer. I wonder if you could elaborate on your comment that it has gotten more challenging to test drinking water over the last decade. And I'll hold the second question.
Eric Schaefer, do you have any thoughts about drinking water programs?
I think that was Dr. Frank's comment.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Frank. I apologize. Dr. Frank, what are your thoughts about the drinking water program impact?
Sure. Yeah, for Indiana, what we're worried about is that we've lost staff within our drinking water program. Indiana's environmental agency has a drinking water program that oversees training and certification of drinking water operators. It provides technical assistance to drinking water systems around the state. And, you know, keep in mind, any site where you have a well that's providing drinking water to 25 people or more is considered a public drinking water system. And so, you know, campgrounds, rural schools, even truck stops can be public drinking water systems. Our agency provides technical assistance, especially to those small systems that can't provide their own, can't hire their own technical staff. With the drop in staff from 62 in 2005 down to 48 in 2019. There's also been a drop of 43% in the technical assistance visits that IDEM has been able to provide to those small systems.
And then,
go ahead, Eric Schaefer.
Just regarding complexity, one example, and this is over the last 10 to 15 years, but a lot of drinking water systems struggle to keep bacteria out of drinking water for obvious reasons. That's really bad for people to drink water with bacteria in it. And the treatment often involves heavy doses of chlorine, and over time the agency EPA and other scientists at other agencies learn that you put too much chlorine in and you create these chlorinated byproducts, which you then have to set a standard for, because you don't want to solve the bacteria problem and create a new one. And that just, you know, that's a matter of kind of water treatment chemistry, that it isn't known when you first set the bacteria standard, and then suddenly you're backing into a new problem that you also have to address. You have to make sure that you're controlling bacteria without overdosing the water supply with chlorine. I don't know if Dr. Frank has experience with that one, but that might be a good example of a standard that, is relatively recent. It's been on the books for a while, but say 20 years ago, it wasn't on the radar as much.
Yeah, there was an update to the federal standard for safe drinking water in regards to bacteria in 2013, and I know that the small drinking water systems in Indiana have struggled to really implement that, and I think if our state agency had more staff, they'd have been able to help those systems get up to date with that bacteria standard.
All right. Next question. And when you ask your question, if you could also identify which publication you're with, that'd be helpful. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Chris Hubbock. Your line is live.
Hi, Chris Hubbock, Wisconsin State Journal. I did find, while on hold here, I found some of the data, the underlying data, which answers part of my question. But I wonder if you could comment in general, over a 10-year period, you're looking at a 10-year period that would include the Great Recession. Did you see a pattern in when these cuts took place? In other words, was this sort of a gradual thing year to year, or were there big drop-offs in certain years?
Eric Schaefer, Environmental Integrity Project.
So I don't have – we do have data for every year. Between 2008 and 2018, we wanted to make sure that we were picking a starting and ending place that was fair and representative of that 10-year period. So we have the data for the intervening years, and we can just give you that. And clearly, the recession had some impact. Interestingly, for some states, because of the federal stimulus package, there was actually a flood of money in 2010-11. Mostly for infrastructure projects, though, mostly for drinking water treatment plants or sewage upgrades, and that's not the kind of spending we were tracking. Mm-hmm. But we do have the numbers for every year. I don't know if you've found those that we've gotten from Wisconsin.
We have a great spreadsheet for every single state, every single year, including Wisconsin. And what is your email? And I'll email it to you right now.
CHUBBUCH at Madison.com.
All right. I'm going to send you a spreadsheet that will show exactly what Wisconsin and all the other states looks like. Basically, in Wisconsin, it looks like from 2011 until 2018, a very sharp and continuous drop. But I'll send that to you now.
Great.
Okay, next question.
Our next question comes from the line of David Jacobs. Your line is live.
Yes, hi. I'm with the CenterSquare.com in Louisiana. And I guess my question is primarily from Ms. Rolfes with the Bucket Brigade, but anyone else can chime in. If you're aware or have ideas of any proposals in terms of how states could find more funding to fund enforcement, whether it's fees, whether it's just higher taxes, whether it's reduction of tax breaks. I don't know, maybe there's any best practices in terms of finding ways to fund these enforcement efforts.
Yeah, well,
Rolfus, go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is certainly, if you know, in my example that I gave of Formosa Plastics in Baton Rouge that's been violating the law for years, how about enforcing the law and fining them? So that's, there's that. You know, I think that if you do an analysis of the very few fines that are levied here in Louisiana, you'd find that they're pretty small. So I'd say answer number one would be to enforce the law and gather the fines. Two would be to fine people, you know, to a level that actually would be a deterrent effect. And then three, just as an example, is Louisiana is not in many cases reaching the levels that it ought to for operating its program. So, for example, many years ago or several years ago, we worked with the Environmental Integrity Project to address the fact that Louisiana does not charge the federally recommended minimum for fees per pound of pollution. So if the clean, I mean, Eric would know what the Clean Air Act recommends, I think something in the $40 range, I don't know, and Louisiana was far below that, you know, in I could go back and look at the information, but was not living up, was not following what the federal government was recommending regarding the fees per pound of pollution. And I am very sure that if you went and did an audit of all of our programs, that we would be charging far less than we ought to be. You might be familiar with an audit, and this is a different state agency, but I think it proves the point of the Department of Natural Resources, how, you know, the fees that they were supposed to be charging industry, you know, were basically, you know, off the books, and nobody was paying attention to whether or not those fees were being calculated. So I think this is one of those rare situations where we need money, but we don't have to do a lot of hand-wringing about where the money ought to come from. Clearly, you know, it should come from industry.
So, Ann, I just happened to be looking at those numbers yesterday because I got a question from another Louisiana reporter. The minimum fee that states are supposed to charge today is $50 per ton of the major pollutants like nitrogen oxide. So if you have a 1,000 tons of nitrogen oxide that you're emitting in a year, you'd pay $50,000. If you had 1,000 tons of sulfur dioxide, you'd pay $50,000 for that. In Louisiana, the fee is just over $14 per ton. So that's a pretty major difference. The state will tell you, I think, that they have other fees that make up the difference. We don't think that's true. When Ann had us look at it, and she has been pushing really hard for fixing this problem for years, we just didn't see how the permit application fees and other fees that the state assessed would make up for charging so little on the actual amount of pollution that Louisiana plants send up the stack.
All right. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Alex Rozier. Your line is live.
Hey, thanks, guys. Eric mentioned how the...
Hey, real quick, Madison, which publication are you with?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Alex Rozier with Mississippi Today.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. Eric mentioned kind of how these budget cuts are coming at the same time that some of these industries that threaten pollution are expanding. And I'm just curious if anyone had kind of any ideas of how to quantify the expansion at the state level.
Quantify the expansion of permits? In other words, how the permitting activity has expanded?
Yeah, or just whatever you think is kind of the best way.
Yeah, I mean, that would be one indicator. And in a state, we have looked at it in a couple of states we already know are incredibly busy, like Louisiana and Texas, where they're just an avalanche of permit applications. That data, actually, Mississippi does a pretty good job of keeping their permit data online. And it would take some work, but I think you could go to the website. They have a search tool that would let you, I think, at least approximate how many clean air permits or how many clean water permits were issued in a given year. So that would be one place to check. You know, we have seen some big new projects going in, and Mississippi, there are a couple of wood pellet plants being proposed for construction. There have been some, there's been some activity at Chevron and Pascagoula, some expansions of oil and gas facilities in the state. So that's, you know, that's more anecdotal. I think the permit activity in the state would, you could go online to get at that. It might, you know, it might take a while to extract that, but they do have some data available.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Cheryl Howe. Your line is live.
Hi, this is Cheryl Hoag with Chemical and Engineering News. I want to take a bigger picture on this. How did this happen? Is this a political thing, or is it with the, as somebody mentioned, the Great Recession? What has been the cause of this decline?
Eric Schaefer?
Well, you know, the Great Recession, we keep hearing from this administration that that's all done. That's over. So there's been enough time to bounce back, in other words, from the low levels that you might have seen, let's say, in especially in 2009, 2010, maybe through 2011. And states are under pressure to, for example, and quite a few have balanced budget requirements, and the federal government doesn't. So we understand there are those budget pressures. That's why we looked at the growth of overall state spending for four or five of the states, where, and we didn't look at all of them. We just looked at a handful where we saw the deepest budget cuts, and we found for those states the spending had, overall state spending had increased in some cases by quite a lot, over 40% in Texas. So they're spending more, quite a bit more than they did in, let's say, in 2008, more than 10 years ago. But that hasn't helped the environmental agency budget. So I don't think the recession is really, when you're looking over this long period of time, I don't think that really explains it.
What might explain it?
Speaking plainly, I think state legislatures are hear from regulated industries all the time. I don't think there's a lot of enthusiasm for having more inspectors come and visit your plant, or, you know, giving the agency more staff to do air quality planning that might result in, you know, more stringent emission limits. And so the politics at the state level are not, you know, not generally friendly toward creating and maintaining healthy budgets for environmental agencies. And I expect a lot of that is unspoken. I don't think people come in. It may be happening, but I don't know how much of this is just a direct assault on the environmental agencies with demands to cut budgets. But, you know, when it comes time to divide up the pie, I don't think the environmental agencies have the clout that some of the other big ones do.
Drew Ball in North Carolina, you had some experience with cuts. Do you want to comment on this at all? What were the politics of North Carolina cutting your environmental agency?
Yeah, you know, here in North Carolina, we actually saw the legislature change hands in 2010. And with that came in a new ideology around what was most effective for management of our state environmental agency. In fact, there was a major reorganization. It used to be the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, and after some reorganizing, it's now the Department of Environmental Quality. But, you know, this ideology that somehow cutting the Department of Environmental Quality was going to be good for business, was going to be good for health of families and communities is certainly backwards. We've seen this backlog of permits to the point that even many businesses aren't happy.
All right. Next question.
There are currently no questions in queue.
Okay. Well, thank you everyone very much for participating. If you have any follow-up questions or need any follow-up data, like I said, we have year-by-year data on each state for each year for staffing and funding. Call me, Tom Pelton, at 202-888-2703, 202-888-2703, or email me at tpelton, T-P-E-L-T-O-N, at environmentalintegrity.org. Also on our website at www.environmentalintegrity.org, if you go to our first item right at the top, you can click on it, get the report, get the whole report, and we have an online web data map where you can click on your state and you can get all the raw data for your individual state for all the different programs. It can be very helpful for your local reporting if you're doing that. All right, well, thanks everyone very much and have a great afternoon.
This concludes this
afternoon's
teleconference. You may disconnect your lines.